Welcome to the Designing Hollywood Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Meyer Burnett. The Designing Hollywood Podcast is dedicated to all things movies, the movie industry, and its talented professionals. And clothes have always been crucial to movie making, and in the early days of powerful Hollywood studios, costume designers not only created looks for film characters, they dressed the stars themselves. And today's episode is sponsored by the Western Costume Company. And with me today for the very first time, I've got Tess McLeod sitting in. Welcome, Tess.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you here.
So excited to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, and we're both excited to have our guest. And this is exciting for me for a reason I was just explaining to you. But let me introduce you. Today's guest is an internationally recognized and prolific feature film costume designer who has been designing for A-listers since the 80s. Working with everyone and anyone from Matt Damon in The Bourne Legacy to Diane Keaton and Mandy Moore in 2007's Because I Said So, 50 Shades Freed, Book Club, and most recent designs in Westworld Season 3, Peacemaker, and A Christmas Story. Nominated for an Emmy and received the Costume Designers Guild Award for Westworld, she trained at the University of Bristol in England and began her design career in the New York Theater. Her first job as costume designer was on Mrs. Soulful, starring Diane Keaton and Mel Gibson. I love that movie. She later worked with Gibson on his directorial debut, The Man Without a Face, and with Keaton on several projects, including The Family Stone. She has worked with an array of distinguished filmmakers, such as James L. Brooks, John Sayles, Gary Sinise, Taylor Hackford, Rob Reiner, Harold Ramis, Steve Zaillian, this is amazing, Brad Soberling, Amy Heckerling, David Mamet, Tarsim Singh, and Ken Kwapis. She tapped into her musical theater roots when she teamed with Rob Marshall. This is the longest intro ever. I hope I haven't even got your name yet. On the television movie version of Annie, to which she won a Costume Designers Guild Award and received an Emmy nomination. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to welcome Academy Award-winning costume designer Shay Cunliffe to the Designing Hollywood Show. Shay, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Glad to be
and
here.
And like I was saying, I mean, you're one of my heroes because you were the costume designer on Blood In, Blood Out, one of the great unsung movies of Los Angeles that we need a 4K release on, which we don't
definitely
have.
Definitely.
So an amazing career. But I think, you know, one of the things that I'm always curious about when we do this is the background of people. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed that a lot of costume designers that I've spoken to have a pretty rigorous academic background. Mm-hmm. A lot of work, a lot of study. How did you begin your career in costume design?
Well, I did a degree in theater at University in England. It wasn't actually specific to design at all. It was a very general, very academic subject. So I really learned on the ground most of what I knew. But it was great to have a grounding. You're going to have to research everything once you're on the job. So anything you come out of college having learned is going to help you. But I moved to New York City and sort of because of people I'd met, fell into the off Broadway world and started going to night school to train for all the technical things I didn't know. I'd sort of narrowed it down that I wanted to specialize in costume design. So I worked for a great director as his assistant. I had the good luck to fall into working as Mike Nichols' assistant for 2 years.
Wow.
And went to a wonderful little design studio at night called Lester Polakoff's. Which sadly is no longer there. It really trained you to get into the New York Union, which was very theater oriented. And I had no sense that I would have a film career. I was aiming to have a theater career.
And now, well, were you a film fan, a theater fan? Did you grow up going to I mean, obviously England has such a rich...
Yes, both. I went to high school in London and the Royal Shakespeare Company, if you were a student, for 5 shillings, which is like, I guess it was a dollar. You could go and see their things. So I would sort of play hooky on school nights and go down to the theater all the time and wait in line, try and get a ticket. And I also loved films. There was a little kind of art house cinema behind my parents' house in Brighton where they were living. And so I would sit on my own on Saturday afternoons and watch whatever it was playing. So I guess I was already like, whatever it is, I'm probably going to find something I'm interested in.
Did you have favorites? What were some of your favorite films and theater growing up?
Well, I guess Fellini, like, probably I think he made it onto every critic's millennial best list. I loved Midnight Cowboy. I loved Women in Love, Ken Russell's
right.
film. I guess that's around about 1970. I think they were probably the...
I just recently picked that up. Women in Love. I'm a huge Ken Russell fan.
I hope it holds up.
You know, I have not watched the disc yet, but I saw it years ago. But I, as I said, I'm a huge Ken Russell. I mean, when he did things like Tommy, you know, the film version of Tommy. I mean,
yes.
And even when he made Altered States, I mean,
yes.
which I love.
All of it was
so good.
And as a costume designer, I think one element that makes his film so great is the costumes were nearly always designed by his wife, Shirley Ruffell,
right.
great costume designer. So, I mean, I'll forgive glitches in filmmaking if the costumes are great.
Right.
My husband goes, who's a production designer, we go to see something and which may not be very good, but he turns to me and he says, oh, I know you dragged me here because you know the costumes were going to be good. Like, what am I doing in this film that no one else wants?
Well, you knew this was a passion of yours, but I see that you didn't think you could draw, so you couldn't get into costume design?
Well, this is a case I didn't even try, really. I actually, in full disclosure, my mother was an artist, a sculptor, a professional sculptor. She actually made the BAFTA award in our garage with her studio. But and my brother and sister were tremendously talented. So I think in families, everyone picks their likely path. My father was a historian and academic. So everyone was like, oh, you're going to be the teacher. Like, you're not the artist in this group. So I sort of accepted it until I actually realized I think this career, costume design to me, it sums up everything I love. I love reading. I love novels. I love stories. I love theater. I love history. I love clothes. I love antique period clothes. I think from about the age of 10, I was in church jumble sales, going through piles of things and finding the odd little Victorian jacket. So it encompassed everything I loved, I realized. But that was the one thing I had no confidence that I knew I needed. Now, a designer going into a career in cinema probably doesn't have to do that at all. There's a tradition in film design that you'll have an illustrator who'll do... Mm-hmm. But for the New York Theater, you had to draw your way into the union. They had a horrendous exam. They locked you in a room for 9 hours, and you had to, on the spot, design on paper and paint all the costumes. And I met a costume designer at an opening night party and was saying, I love what you do. I'd love to do that, but I can't draw. And she said, well, that's not something you can or can't do. That's something you learn to do, which... I don't know. It never really occurred to me. It felt like you're innately good at that.
Right.
So I started going to the Art Students League on weekends and at Lester Polakoff's studio. I did classes and I can't say they were wonderful. They're very childlike, but I realize that some very great designers have very childlike drawings too.
And so how long did you hone your skills as an artist?
Well, it's not, I was lucky. I think I was like 26, 27 years old when I started trying to put it all together. And I'd been working, you know, since I was 21 in sort of professional, you know, as assistants to people. And so it happened faster than I could believe. In New York, if you're prepared to take on a play with no budget that's off Broadway at La Mama, and they're going to pay you $50 and give you a budget of $150. And if you say, sure, I'll try that. So I was that person where someone said, would you want to take it on? And so almost instantly, I was sort of designing. And and then very quickly, a costume designer hired me to be her assistant on an opera because I had all the skills you need are organization and getting on with people. You could have been running a restaurant and go into costume design as long as you have an eye and a sense.
Sure.
You will use the same skills.
Were you, when you started in the theater, even though you were off Broadway, did you have any designs on becoming, well, to be actually on Broadway and to design and then move into film?
Yeah, well, the film bit I'd never really thought about, partly because I was living in New York and it's such a theater city. But I somewhat drew my way into that union. Instead, though, I got a job. I actually got hired at Seattle ACT Theater
sure.
for the summer
wow.
to do a couple of little plays for them.
When, do you remember when this was?
So,
because I've seen many a play there.
It was like 1981, 82.
Oh. I was very much going to plays then, and then I was a big film, the Seattle Film
yes.
Festival. But that went on was a big part of my life.
Well, one of them was Crimes of the Heart, the Beth Henley play I did.
I did not see that.
And Educating Rita I did, which was...
Wow.
And I went back another year and did another one. But anyway, so I did the first part of the interview to get into the New York Union. And then I said, I can't come back for this like horrendous 9 hours alone in a room drawing. I am going to be in Seattle designing something. So they let me in. I think they sort of saw this person's probably going to end up, we're going to see more of her. Like, why are we torturing her? I feel that was the conversation probably when I left the interview room. But
when were you working with Mike Nichols? When did you find yourself?
Oh, that was, it was very random and serendipitous. I arrived in New York out of college and stayed in, my aunt was a New Yorker. I have an American branch to my family. My aunt was a writer and a New Yorker, and she was away and said, you can stay in my flat while I'm gone, my apartment while I'm gone. And she had rented another room in her apartment to a writer who, just so that writer could get away from her family and be left alone. So we would chat late at night. I was working as an office temp. I was earning about $90 a week. I was like, I don't know what my plan is next. And she said, oh, you'd really like the people at the New York Review of Books. And I said, I love the New York Review of Books. And she said, oh, we'll give Barbara Epstein a call. Tell her she ought to meet you. So I managed to get a job there, not at once, but I went to meet, and when they had an opening, they called me, and I was working there, and it was a great office in New York. They only actually have about 10 people getting that publication up and running. Maybe it's more now, and every night, well, the assistants, of course, are there, last ones to lock up and putting all the things in order for the next morning. And everyone, all the sort of interesting folk and writers of New York would come and mooch there. They would like check what galleys had come in. They'd say to me, what's interesting that I worked for Robert Silvers, who's actually was a great editor. He was my boss. Like, what does Bob think is good right now? And and it was a man called Luis Sanjurjo used to hang around and do that. And he said, you know, Mike Nichols has hired me to be like associate producer with him, and he's opening an office in Times Square, and he needs a great assistant. But he said, mainly Mike can't bear things being badly written and misspelled. And I'm pretty sure you won't misspell any letter that you're writing on his behalf.
Now, did you know that he like had directed The Graduate?
I knew. I loved The Graduate. I incredibly loved Catch 22.
Yep.
I'd have to put that on one of my favorite films. I knew nothing about the Elaine Mays and Mike Nichols side of his life. I didn't really understand at all what he represented, even then when he was in his 40s. But even then, I didn't realize what a figure he was. My friends in New York Theater were like, what? You're going to have an interview with Mike Nichols? this is ridiculous.
Oh my God.
And I went up to the Carlyle, which I'd never been in before, on the Upper East Side. But I guess, I mean, it was fine. He said, yeah, I think this will be great.
Wow.
So I did that for 2 years, and it was actually second year I was working with him. And it was through him that I got to go to opening nights, met the costume designer who told me, why don't you learn to draw? And I'd met another costume designer who gave me very, very good advice about go to Lester Polakoff's, because I said, I can't afford to start again. I can't sort of suddenly apply to NYU or Yale for a master's degree. I'm like earning my living, actually.
Right.
So there is hope if you aren't, you know, if you, I, didn't actually have connected parents and I didn't have a bunch of money. I was just, but I did have the luck of wonderfully helpful friends that I just made in very random ways.
Well, I think that's true of the entertainment business. I've always said to people, you know, work begets work. You never know. Yes. You never know who you're going to randomly run into.
Exactly.
And I found that to be true in Los Angeles when I first came down here to go to film school. And you just never knew what random you'd bounce around. Like you might even be at a party that you weren't even planning to go to, that a friend dragged you to. And then you wind up talking to somebody and they're like, you hit it off. And then they tell you who they are. And you're like, wow, really?
Oh, yeah. You should, all about connections.
Yeah, I mean, you should come to this. And then suddenly, but you have to have the work. I mean, that's the thing.
And a serious interest. You can't just...
The
star thing, I really didn't and don't care about. Talent is a very exciting thing in people, but prestigious positions, I don't...
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Now, we talked about Blood In, Blood Out, and then you worked on Dolores Claiborne again. Mm-hmm. I'm always curious about the relationship between, to me, costume designers and hair and makeup people are two of probably the most important hires on any film, because they're your first line of defense with your actors.
Mm-hmm.
Your actors have to know when they walk out in front of that camera that they look great. They can't be thinking about that because they're thinking about their character and all that. And I think that's true also of when you're working with directors, they trust you. For the most part.
And a few don't. I mean, it's not they don't trust you. Some are anxious and micromanage you, which is actually kind of very hard to get. Yes, but some say, I'm so busy, do it, do your thing.
That's interesting to me. You're the first person to say that about directors micromanaging, because I would think that, I mean, unless they know about clothes, aren't they hiring everyone does their jobs. Wouldn't they defer to you?
It's actually, there's a huge spectrum of what your relationship will be. And now I tend to start the relationship off by saying, how do you like to work? Do you want to see everything? Do you want me sending you pictures at any hour of the day or night? Do you want to approve every single... I mean, I've never worked with one of this kind, but I've heard of directors who want to see every extra what they're going to be wearing.
Wow.
It's mainly just... so time consuming on a tight schedule.
Right.
But then there are others. I did a film that I bet you haven't seen this, The Fifth Estate with Bill Condon.
Yeah, that was good. No, I have seen
you
that.
Have seen,
well,
yes.
Seen well, I do say everything. I'm a Bill Condon fan.
Yeah.
You know, ever since Candyman 2.
He was wonderful. And that was the story of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And,
yeah, but it was Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yes, Benedict Cumberbatch.
I mean, he's no slouch.
I think we had like a 3-week prep. It suddenly got greenlit. I think Benedict suddenly had these 2 months available for us. So it was crazy hectic. And we were in multiple countries shooting. And I was really like hit the ground running and go. And I, at about 2 weeks in, I turned to Bill and said, you know, I haven't shown you anything. I'm just like getting it done. Do you want me to start sending you things? How do you like to do? He said, oh, please. Just go. Like,
I don't know if you know Jack Morrissey, who knows Bill very well, but he's an old friend of mine. So I'm a huge Bill Condon fan. He can do no wrong in my book. So I like The Fifth Estate. I thought that was a pretty good movie.
Yes, I think the tide turned against Julian Assange right about then, and the Snowden business. They hadn't yet made the film, but it was taking up the news space.
Right.
So it's so tricky with a project. It can be wonderful, but just certain world events come to pass.
When you're working, do you prefer to have more prep time, or in the case of Fifth Estate, you're just thrown into the deep end?
I think I would love more prep time. About 80% of the time that you don't get enough. Now, I know the huge Marvel things, which I have not done, they allow people a year to develop it.
Right.
That I might kind of lose the adrenaline on, because there is something about your adrenaline gets ignited. But the short preps are nerve-wracking. You just have to trust your instinct, and it's fantastic to be with people who are just saying, I'm liking what I'm seeing.
Well, speaking of the comic book milieu. I mean, you recently did Peacemaker, which I think was one of the most delightful surprises of the television season.
Oh, thank you.
And now you inherited Peacemaker because Peacemaker came from Suicide Squad, but you did get to create costumes. You had Judo Master, you had Vigilante. You said you hadn't done a Marvel movie, but hey, DC's pretty good too.
Yes, yes, no.
And working with somebody like a James Gunn had to have been
an incredibly great experience. Yes, I think that's what was so exciting. It's not quite my genre, and that's always sort of gets me like, yes, I want the one that's not looking easy for me to do. I want that learning curve. He was phenomenal, and it's no surprise really that he is so organized and knows so much where he's going. I don't know how we, if we were also getting the benefit of a year of COVID lockdown. We started production on that, not shooting, but pre-production started for me in early September of 2020. And James had been like in his living room for the since March. Right. And he had written all 8 scripts in advance. He had playlists to accompany all the scripts that he shared. When you got the script, you got the playlist for it. He had storyboarded it all himself. I don't think I've ever known that degree of knowing what you want and very, very decisive. I shared what I was proposing, fitting folders, but it was yes, yeah, great, no, something, I know I want more, but one line, okay, get it.
Well, I'm curious, when you delve into these comic book films have become so important as far as Hollywood is concerned. Mm-hmm. And the evolution of comic book characters on screen, especially the way the costumes are made and designed, has really changed. Because it used to be, if you even go back and look at Christopher Reeve and Superman in 1978, it was that classic spandex.
Baggy tights kind of look. One. Hopefully not too baggy. But
yeah, they don't do that anymore. And I think the sophistication, the superhero costume, as a kid growing up, I've always loved superhero comics. I still collect comics. But you got to do things like Vigilante. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, when you're tasked with creating a character like Vigilante, do you go back in and look at the history of that character from the comic book standpoint? Do you go in and look at when he was first introduced or his own? What kind of research and prep do you do to create a costume like Vigilante?
This was an interesting thing in that they called me, so in 2020, complete lockdown, and not a lot of prep time on this. I think it was going to be 2.5 months till we started shooting. And because we were so close to the wire, they said, listen, we've already started a dialogue with Russ Shinkel at Film Legacy, Film Illusions. He's an incredible manufacturer of these costumes. I think he did Black Panther, he did Aquaman. It's like a museum in his business. He had already done some preliminary sketches and they said, so take it on from here. And I didn't mind that at all. I was grateful because he had probably, he never really shared with me what conversation he'd had, but I assumed that they'd begun to refine it. So I sort of looked at what Russ's workroom had come up with. And then I sort of, it's interesting, like you mentioned Vigilante and the original one. I felt that they, in their design, had slightly lost that very distinctive across the body line.
Yeah.
It was more grungy looking. And I thought, which James wanted as a feel, like very do-it-yourself costume. But I came in more as a designer, just looking at it like, no, you've lost the line here. Let's change that. Judo Master is too dark. I think he was in that dark evil thing. And I said, we're shooting at night in woods. Let's lighten that up so we can see the guy. And so I didn't have the task of like starting the dialogue, which I was sort of relieved for.
Sure.
At that moment.
But I do love the fact that that's interesting that you brought back the classic Vigilante look, that the black with the, because that line work broke up the costume.
Yes.
The blue offset the black, and same with the cowl as well.
The visor. Which that was such a palaver getting that to work for an actor and on the face. My respect for the people who make these and what it involves has gone up 100-fold.
Yeah.
Fire off.
Yeah. So yes. You've worked with Russ at Film Illusions, who is just such a mastermind when it comes to this. I've been to his warehouse and it is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. You know, he has all those costumes in there and it's so great. What was your dialogue like with him when preparing for the costumes? Because you only had a couple of months, and these take like 6 to 8 weeks to make, usually, like one costume, with the dyeing and over dyeing and like finding these really specific like stretch twills or anything like that. Like, what was that like discussing it with him?
Well, he's a man of few words, as you'll know, which is a bit disconcerting. It would be like a message, one sentence, like, if we don't put this in the works, like, by Friday, we're going to... So...
It's a bunch up here, but on here, it's not as much, it's but not... it's brilliant.
So I think, first day on the job, I went right over there to kind of talk to him about the genesis of what he'd done thus far. No fabrics had been chosen, so then I got, like... leapt into what we were going to achieve. And then you get the specialty stretchy great fabric, then it goes to the sort of printer who puts the texture on it, then Russ is going to paint into it. Poor Russ, I did drive him a bit crazy because Judo Master came back very pastel looking, and I was calling him from up in Vancouver like, Russ, this is like a little girl's outfit, like And he's like, no, I'm going to do something to it. So I'm like, well, could you send me, like, could you FedEx me, like, examples of what you're going to do? So I drove him a little crazy, too. He had to kind of work with me a bit. And I'm like, oh, okay, good. Just check it. But it was interesting because you weren't allowed in and out of Canada at the time that we made it.
Oh,
and
interesting.
And projects that go between LA and Vancouver, which is millions of them, are used to the designer flies back for a fitting in LA if it's being made in LA, or the man, or someone like Russ would normally have flown up to Vancouver for the day to be part of the fittings.
Yeah, of course.
So we did quite a lot on Zoom. First fitting, so first two fittings, the actor was there with Russ. And I had an assistant designer here in LA who went along too to hold the thing and write notes for me as well. And then I luckily, because we had to, although we did inherit the design of Peacemaker, we actually had to make it ourselves. We weren't allowed to say, oh, cool, let's unwrap the Suicide Squad.
Oh my gosh.
No, it was like, sure, you're going to recreate him, but it's up to you guys how you do that. And I knew, James Gunn having... you know, being part of his origination in the Suicide Squad, I knew this had to be perfect, like not just sort of like the TV version of what a feature film has. So luckily, there are incredible workrooms in Vancouver too. So we had a workroom busy on recreating Peacemaker. And Russ, that made Russ feel good because I said, listen, Shay is our cutter up here. He said, oh yeah, I know Shay. She's very good. So we sort of did the last leg then. So he got things 7/8 done down in LA, and then we took it over.
Wow.
And that's when all the, like, I can't move, actually.
Right.
We were dealing with that up in Vancouver. And...
Of course.
How many multiples did you have to make of that Peacemaker suit?
I think we had 20.
Oh my gosh.
I know, I have had a great photo I sent James where they're all on a rack, like we lined them
this
up.
This is your work.
Well, I said the closet, the magic closet at his father's house, I said it might be cool. I mean, to my mind, that likes an explanation for how costumes, where they come from, what's their story. I felt better about we're going to put him in a fresh one when one gets too messed up by the previous episode's violence and blood and filth. So, okay, then we can go into a new costume because we know where it came from. And I said, why can't we, like, show that his dad's literally made him? And they liked that idea and they shot it, but if I'm right, they didn't put it in the end of all. They might thought it undercut the magic.
Yeah, I don't think that they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you saw the lot of helmets, but not that crazy rack of costumes.
Do you want to go on?
Well, you worked with or Judianna, she did the first
original
Peacemaker. When did you speak with her at all?
Totally.
When it came
soon as I got this job, I called her, and I've known Judianna. We were both assistant designers in New York around about 1982, so I knew her back then very well too. She was incredibly helpful.
Oh, great.
So
and that's Judianna Makowski.
Yes. brilliant designer. And so she was also very helpful, saying, oh, you're going to love working with James. He's incredibly collaborative. And then said, but the Peacemaker costume was actually much more complicated than it looks. It's got a billion costume pieces to
it. Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh.
So I said, well, what would be great is if you have any costumer in Atlanta where you've shot it, if they could go into the warehouse and get me a hero costume that you could ship up to us in Vancouver so we have an actual real one. We're not just looking at like screen grabs.
Yeah, so you have something that's tangible.
So they got that. I mean, that was complicated because like every production in the middle of March in 2020, they were given 3 hours to wrap Suicide Squad when they thought they'd have a couple months wrap. And it was pandemonium of a mess of the warehouse. I also had to find a costumer who could get the COVID test for the approval of the warehouse guy who also needed a COVID test to go and unlock the warehouse. That
Holy
was sort
cow.
Of like a costume adventure on its own.
Yeah.
So they went in there, they got that costume out, and Juliana called me and said, you know, I think they've found maybe the original pattern pieces. I'm like, that would be unbelievable. And sure enough, a box arrived that said Peacemaker, and it would look like it was full of pattern pieces. And I'm like, oh, well, the workroom, I'm still down in L.A., fitting the actors who are still here. The workroom in Vancouver called me and said, this doesn't look anything like Peacemaker, this box. They hold them up on FaceTime, and it's polka dot. It's the polka dot guy got put in
the
Peacemaker box from the movie.
Yeah.
And they're like, how can this have happened? I'm like, just think of 3 hours to wrap that movie and everyone's paranoid as hell about COVID.
Oh, my God.
Wow. But, hey, you could have recreated that. You know, Man was a great character, too.
Yeah. Well, so they reverse engineered the Peacemaker. Luckily, I mean, we didn't take apart the hero costume we had, but it allowed them to really understand, yes, it's like all kinds of pieces, making it like slim but movable
right.
for that.
Oh, that's so great.
Did you make stunt versions of that costume as well?
Yes.
Now, did you have to do anything different, like add, I don't know, extra padding or something?
We always make them looser, a couple inches, a little bit looser. I actually usually make a set that's a little bit looser for the actor, too, because some of them are very gung-ho about sort of semi-stunts themselves. Mm. So you can get a back pad in, you can get the knee pads in. But we pretty much, they were completely custom-made for the stuntman. And not to keep harping about what it's like working under COVID times, but we also had like several hiccups when the primo stuntman for that part got a COVID positive.
Oh.
And then we're rushing into a different stuntman, and their stunts are so demanding, their costume must be theirs. It can't be sort of.
Right.
So we were in a great rush adapting and making for, I think we had several stuntmen by the time we got through. But every character had their stuntman's costume.
Now I'm curious too about, this is kind of random, but one of the great things about Peacemaker is the opening dance number. and you know, I'm curious, like, being that you came from the theater, like suddenly you are tasked with taking your entire cast and putting them in the proper costumes to dance. Was that a special thing? Like because that opening sequence, that was one of the first things.
Fantastic.
It's fantastic. You look at this, like, how did this happen? But it had to have been coordinated. Did you get to design just that sequence in terms of the costumes?
Yes, it was very quickly done because James wasn't sure for a long time what he wanted. He's like, we're going to put a pin in that. We're going to do some special sequence. And it suddenly came on us in a great rush. It might have been that we had actors there that were going to leave soon. And so this is the moment. They were all here. And they rehearsed. They have a wonderful choreographer, Krista, who came up, and she and I talked a lot about what she was planning, because I realized that they're not dancers, so what are you expecting of them? And you've also got like an 85-year-old man who is the next door neighbor who James wants dancing. And James said, I just want them to look like themselves, not like special costumes at all, but not something they're wearing in the series. So it's got to be just reserved for that. And then that we were going to do it in the headquarters, that very grungy ex old mm-hmm. video store.
Right.
And she rehearsed in there, and that was sort of thinking, well, I've got to stand out a bit because it's so dark and grungy in there. But that was one thing when you thought it was all going to be in that space. But literally like half a week before we shot it, they went and rehearsed. It was obviously not big enough for what they wanted. They decided they would build a stage. Then James realized he wanted something a little more wow fun. The production designer came up with a design incredibly quickly, and we were all very good at sharing. She immediately shared with me what it looked like, and I'm like, well, this is like a lot jazzier I'd better jazz it up a little. So that's where I think like Adebayo's girlfriend ends up thing. And Adebayo herself has got the bright red jacket on, and I sort of tried to give everyone the brighter version of their closet.
Oh, great.
But it was fun, and I shot it all in a day. It was a fantastically fun day.
Oh, it's and when you're watching the show for the first time, it comes out of nowhere, and you're like, this is the greatest TV opening I've ever seen.
I'm not expecting that. Like, their faces are so, like, serious. Yeah, no. And then they're dancing.
Well, the first, and of course, like, someone like Danielle Brooks, who's so expressive, and first take, she's like looking, and then James said, no, I want like no emotion on anyone.
So cold.
And every actor came for a fitting. For Harcourt, I went through several more, in my opinion, like more exciting options. I made her a sort of a black vinyl cat suit.
Ooh.
That was like sort of thinking of Honor Blackman in The Avengers, which from my childhood. And I also was sort of slightly inspired by looking at the original music video for that song.
Oh, nice.
And the person, the great woman in the...
Right.
But it seemed too glamorous to James. And I think I got a note. And then I made another one with like a white stripe down the edge.
Ooh.
To be... But I think he felt like the costume was like overtaking the person. And then he also said, don't you have something sleeveless? She's like been working out like mad.
Her muscles.
Yes.
Awesome.
So we actually ended up for her at the very last minute throwing together what she wore. But I was skeptical about that. I couldn't quite understand. And so every actor came for a fitting for their choice. And I would ask them all to do their moves. I couldn't quite see how this little thing they were showing me in the fitting cubicle was going to add up. It was really an interesting day.
Oh my gosh.
Well, it worked out great.
Yes.
You know, and now I've noticed, and I'm not saying anyone's copying anyone else, but like in the new season of Umbrella Academy, when the Umbrella Academy meets the Sparrow Academy, there's a flash, a Footloose dance number. And I'm like, is this the new thing? Are they with superheroes there? We're all going to see them dancing.
Like little flash mobs.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, hey, if that's where you're going to go, delightful. You know.
Yeah.
But it was great. You know, that show, like when you're working on something like that, that was a really, It was 8 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So you're working on 8 episodes. What was the production time on a show like that? Like, how long were you on that show?
I started in September, prepping. We got up to Vancouver at Thanksgiving, and we started shooting late January, I think, or early February. The last couple episodes was all in continuity. And I ended up leaving early. I had a phenomenal associate designer called Karen Nozella, who's a costume designer in Vancouver. And because I knew that we were going to be two branches, I was going to be prepping LA. I needed a lot of prep to start in Vancouver. She's been my assistant on a film called 2012, and she was my assistant on the 250 Shades movies.
Oh, nice.
And I said, Karen, would you consider, and she'd become a costume designer in her own right. I said, would you consider like coming along so I know that I've got someone awesome, like up there in the north? So she took it over from me.
Great.
And I left early. So I got out about May, middle of May.
Wow, but that's still a long time, November to May.
And I sat alone for Thanksgiving and Christmas, no, like, possibility of...
Because you couldn't leave.
Couldn't leave.
Oh.
Sat alone for 14 days, arrived in 14 days, not allowed to leave at all.
Oh, my gosh.
And actually, just zooming into them at work, it was... a unique time.
Very much so. Is there any talk of doing a season two?
Yes, there is. I think sometime in 2023 is what.
Because I think it was sort of, it came out of nowhere and was an unexpected hit. I mean, it was, you just didn't know coming out of Suicide Squad they're going to make. Because I know they greenlit the series before the movie had even come out. They talked about they're going to make a Peacemaker series. And obviously John Cena must have had a great time with James Gunn. And he said, let's do it. Having that cast, just watching the show, that cast must have been fun to work with.
Delightful. Every single one of them.
That show is, I can't imagine making that was, you must have been laughing half the time.
Yes, particularly with Robert Patrick and his like wild, like facing. I sort of cheated the COVID rules a bit because I realized first fittings, I let everyone keep the mask on. It's like, you can't sell a costume without the actor. I'm sorry, guys. I'm going to risk our lives in this room. Please take your mask off. We'll keep ours on, but let me get a...
Well, you have to know.
There is no look without a face.
Mm-hmm. That's how it's going to be presented in the end. So you want to see how it's going to look, of course.
But they were all... Chuck came in just at the last minute from England. He's a fabulous English stage actor. He was wonderful, wonderful. No, it was altogether a great. I'm delighted for Danielle because it was her first sort of foray into being action person.
What a fun show. I mean, all the work you guys put in on that just popped off the screen as well.
Thank you.
One of the great delightful surprises of last year, or I guess it was this year. It was 2022.
It came out. Did it? Yes. I was shooting in Bulgaria and didn't get to see it till I'd like all in a rush till I got back.
Where were you in Sofia?
In Sofia.
Did you shoot
at a Christmas story?
New Boyana?
No, we were in some like weird little TV studio where they were simultaneously doing some Eurovision stuff, which was very surreal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've shot in Bulgaria. I like Sofia. It's a lot of fun.
It was a lovely, lovely place.
It's great because your crew speaks like six different languages. You feel like it's the smartest bunch of people I've ever worked with.
It was a little odd. We were recreating like small town America, 1970s. And I realized that one's understanding of the right person for the witch costume is a very cultural thing. And so the first day of fittings, some like expansive grandmotherly type with wild red hair comes out dressed as a hippie because they had mentioned they wanted hippies on the call sheet. And I realized they probably thought that was okay because she had this wonderful hair and they'd been looking at pictures of the 70s. And I'm like, no, she's too old.
The new Christmas story?
Yes. So the original one was set in 1940s.
Right. Bob Clark directed that.
Yes. And this one is actually directed by Clay Catus, who comes from animation, who did a previous Christmas Chronicles movie. But he has all the original actors back.
Yeah, Peter Billingsley.
Peter Billingsley, but not just him. Like Zach, the town bully, the kid bully.
Scott Farkas.
Yes.
Oh, my
Scott
gosh.
Scott Farkas is back. The friend with the tongue stuck to Scott Schwartz is back. Yeah.
It's amazing.
It was really enticing. But so it's now 1970s, and Peter Billingsley has grown up, and he goes back home for Christmas and takes his own family with him.
Peter and I used to work together. I edited a film with him. Mm-hmm. Along in the 90s. I love Peter. He's great.
Yes. He was great fun to be in Sofia with. He's an all-round like great impresario.
Yes.
And he arranged like great dinners every Saturday night. I don't think I've ever had so much fun. I was not expecting it.
Well, is that an HBO Max show?
I think they're jamming now too for it to be the Christmas offering.
Sure. That's great.
Yeah.
I mean, that's going to be fun to see. Was it fun to recreate the 70s?
Yes, it was great. I shipped just about everything from here and I'm really glad I did. Because It was not
the 70s were different in Bulgaria.
Yes, I know. You know, we did score a whole bunch. I went to the New Boyana costume stock, which would be fabulous if you were doing a bunch of Huns coming over the mountains. Right. They got that down. But the 70s were a little ragged, but I found a bunch of 70s shirts and took them all. But then I noticed they all had weird comic rounded collars, you know, which was a very minor aspect. But it obviously was really big.
In those communist countries.
They really like that. So I felt bad because we rented a rack of them, but every time we put them on someone, I was like, no, I can't do that.
Yeah, I was there in 2008 and mm-hmm. they were only a Soviet satellite less place mm-hmm. for less than 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, because they were full on communist state.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Finally, I wouldn't imagine there would be a lot of 70s wear.
No, sadly.
Comrade.
No great vintage. I thought there might be some great vintage. There are some wonderful, strange, contemporary, super cheap emporiums of stuff, which I was there too quite a lot.
Well, you know, where do you see like now in terms of there's a lot changing in the industry now, but mm-hmm. the costume designer's job hasn't changed really, has it?
No, in fact, it's a little infuriating because technology has allowed a huge amount of speedy transmission of stuff, but actually in real time, it's very much the same job I've always done. It takes a person the time to get to know them. It takes actual things and they actually have to fit. And I feel there's a bit of a disconnect of time allocated to get things done.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Then,
is that something that's relatively new? Because
I think it's crept in and the form it takes is like casting the night before they shoot.
Right.
And it's because you can whiz a contract via email. Everyone can e-sign it. That side of the business has...
Well, that's really interesting. Right. I mean, we haven't talked about that on this show before. And I think that people need to be mindful of that. You producers out there, don't do that to your costume designers. But I think that's a really valid point because you need to have somebody come in and... I mean, what are you supposed to do? Come in at 5 a.m. so we can put...
Yeah, well, that's what you do quite a lot. You're actually going to be in at 5 a.m. and see them before they want them on camera at 7:30.
Yeah, it's not good.
Not at all, no. I mean, no. I mean, what I do when I'm trapped in that, if I possibly can, and it depends on where they're coming from, what the deal is I will ship, I'll FedEx a box to a costume. So say it's in someone coming from New York. I started there. I know a lot of designers. They help me out. I'll FedEx things I think should work mm-hmm. and have them go to their place and at least get me started with something to shoot that first day.
Right.
I did that, was it Mercedes Rule, was in this a project I liked a lot that was called Indictment, the McMartin preschool story. It was it was all the years of that crazy court case all through the 70s into the 80s. Mm-hmm. And Mercedes Rule, I think she was in a theater thing, couldn't come early. So I shipped a huge box to a costume designer friend of mine in New York to go to her apartment, try it all on. What came back was like these two things work great. The rest, nah. But I knew I could get through the first day of shooting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But then like we would be like doing catch up on.
Right.
Well, that's to me also. So this is really, you know, as far as literally producers mm-hmm. should know this. What are some other things that have changed that have made your job more difficult in this modern era of streaming and movie making?
I don't know that it's technology that's done this, but the demand for lots of options. Like there's working with people who don't sort of trust the actor liked it, the director liked it, you thought it was good. Mm-hmm. This element that you're going to have to like always have lots of other things to show some producers who might be there. That's and of course I've learned over the years always have something a few other things in your back pocket because you get to the set and it might be they change the drapes and it's like oh well now we've got a problem. It's always good. You have to have a fix to anything that might be happening. But there seems to be an increasing demand. Like, what? You don't have lots more? You don't have more? Mm. And it's each look, it takes so much time to get it all together, for it to be right for the character, right for the body, right for the budget, right for...
How important is the relationship that you have with your production designer and with your director of photography in terms of designing?
Very close. They're the first day on the job. I go to the art department and take a look at everything they've done and talk to them about what I'm thinking of doing. Yeah, go sit down in with the DP in his little room and... or her little room, and say how anything I need to know about how you're shooting it, anything special. Yeah, it's crucial. And then everyone gets very busy and we race by each other saying, sorry, I haven't shown you that yet. The ambition is to be super in touch. You certainly start out that way.
Also, another thing that you've, throughout your career, you've lived through the transition from film to digital capture technology. Mm-hmm. Has that affected the way you design in terms of, fabrics and things like that? Because the way they look different in different mediums, or has that not affected you at all?
I mean, it does a bit. It seems there's less anxiety about strobing than there used to be.
Right.
And it seems teching whites seems less of an issue. I think an awful lot of things can actually be fixed with manipulation of dials. Mm-hmm. So there is a little bit less pressure on you've got to nail it, right? Because for years, the corduroy wasn't okay.
You would get the moire.
Yes, or the stripes in a shirt are too close. I know it gets so that you know it. I think any person standing in a shop who I said, just hold it and think, does it make you feel a bit dizzy? Don't use it. That's the end of...
Well, it's the technology. I mean, filmmaking is always based. I've always said it's the greatest art form because you take all the previous art forms and you have the added spin of technology. Yes.
Yeah. Well, there is one thing that's good and bad that I miss with new technology is that in the old days, it would add an extra couple hours to your work day, but you would drive to wherever they were screening dailies.
Right.
And you would watch them properly on a thing. And it was a fantastic thing because it would only be a handful of people there. And it would be, and the director and the cinematographer, production designer were there. And you could right away, they could lean over to your seat and say, you know, I'm not sure about...
Right.
Or afterward, or even quite irrelevantly from what you just watched, it's a moment where they're not like in the middle of setting up the shot and you say, can we talk about that scene we're shooting next week for a minute? Because I have these questions. It was a brilliant way... to kind of...
Are you watching dailies now digitally?
They just send them, they send them through a portal, Pixel always. Mm-hmm. And it's always a little bit glitchy for me, who's not like tech fabulous, but it's always like...
But you're watching it alone.
You're watching it in an annoying... on your computer. You're
is not as helpful as it could be if you're watching it on a big screen, because you can't...
Yeah.
Sometimes you miss details and things like that.
So,
interesting.
But on the plus side for getting to see it, there's monitors. On most projects, there's monitors all over the set. Mm-hmm. So I check on everything, you know, top of the day. Later in the day, I'll go see what they're up to. And so you're seeing it there, which you didn't used to be able to.
Interesting. Okay.
Do you find yourself on set a lot during filming, or do you stay more in the office and try to like oversee what's happening there, or do you like
it's
both?
It really depends on so many factors. Mm-hmm. If there are problems with the set, I'm there much more.
Right.
It's like mom is here.
Uh-huh.
I know.
The day.
I'm there to help out the costumers, so because it's not really their job to shoulder issues. It's mm-hmm. mine. Anything new that's working, I'm there. So I'm there usually always in the morning getting ready. Mm-hmm. Rare exception is they're in a scene that's going to take a few days to do.
Right.
Continuity. And then it depends how busy you are, because you're having to get off set. You've got fittings set up with a big cast. You're just racing to get to the fitting room. Sometimes it doesn't work that you can get back to the shop because they're going to establish something else on set. It's an hour's mm-hmm. drive.
Yeah.
Then you'll ask for an extra trailer to be made available to you. with day players, occasionally when there's no extra trailer, they've just come in the back of the costume truck and I've kicked everyone out. It's pretty much like backstage at the theater time all over again.
Right. Oh, yeah. Full circle.
Yeah, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about Diane Keaton.
Oh, I
you
love
know, one of I mean, one of the all the way back to Annie Hall, you know, one of the most stylish and Kay in The Godfather. Yes. But she's one of the most stylish women, you know, in America.
Yes.
And and what is it like to work with her? And how do you, when you're already dealing with such a fashion powerhouse, what is the relationship that a costume designer develops with someone like a Diane Keaton?
Well, we got to develop it on my very first film, Mrs. Sofol, where I was really, I'd come from theater and it was a know-nothing. And we enjoyed each other's company back then. And for a little while after we wrapped that film, so we wrapped it in 1984, she and I would occasionally go to a movie in New York, which was kind of surreal because it was in the height
of,
like,
gosh.
I know. And we'd meet for in a little Italian restaurant and go to a movie, and they'd be sending over free drinks, which I wasn't used to. I mean,
she's kind of the queen of New York.
Yes.
I mean.
Yeah.
So, and then I lost touch with her. I think I came out to LA, didn't see her. So I was incredibly happy to be reunited on The Family Stone.
Right.
And then we got on a roll. Then we had Family Stone, Because I Said So, and I think we did something called Mama's Boy that never really got released with Jeff Daniels and John Heder.
Oh.
And that was the hardest in a way because she was a mousy secretary with a belligerent son, John Heder, who wouldn't leave home. And I had to, like, talk her. It was like talking someone down from what of looking really ordinary. How was I going to make it okay, but really ordinary?
Of course.
And what'd you tell her?
Well, we just tried a lot of stuff. I think every job has started with her being several notches more deeply fabulous than the character really should be. So we start there, and then I say, I don't think the bowler hat can fly in this. And then, like, I think the proportion is a little bit too stylish for this.
Right.
And she's like, oh, okay. Yes.
Oh, well, you know, before we wrap up, I wanted to ask just quickly about Westworld, too. I mean, the costumes, that had to have been a fun show to work on for you.
It was. It was a whole new thing, 30 to 50 years into the future.
Right.
And how are we going to accomplish it? Again, I think I had a 2-month prep on the whole series, which was, I had to be very cheap and cheerful, as we talk about clothes being cheap and cheerful, meaning just get on with it wherever it comes from, make it work.
Well, I mean, the third season obviously was very different than the first two seasons as well. And you got to do, like, modern, futuristic contemporary.
And 1940s.
Yeah.
For the War World one, which both great challenges. I was a little disappointed when I realized there would be no Western carry-on. I thought when I went for the job, but they didn't have scripts yet. I thought, oh, great, at least they're going to have a massive stock of great Western stuff. So that's taken care of. But then I get there, and we did a couple flashbacks.
Right.
But it partly came about that way because the Western town was destroyed in the terrible fires.
Right.
But it was a huge challenge for me. I hadn't done that kind of level of episodic TV before.
Another HBO show, so they love you at HBO.
Yeah, I know. I never remember who the production company was on my jobs. I more remember the director, the actors.
Sure.
Only very recently I thought, dang, I have done a lot with them. Like, no wonder they're very pleasantly hands off with me.
Before we wrap up, you know, one of the questions we want to ask is, what advice could you impart to young people coming up and wanting to get into the industry? What can people do today?
I think it was a lot of good luck I had, but I still think, like, good luck and being game for anything is actually still the recipe. It's always hard work. It was hard work when I started. It's hard work now. So if you're, you have to love it a lot, because it's going to take everything and go for it. I think a design sense is innate, And all the other bits you're going to learn. Every single job I did had a learning curve for me. Mm. And so my colleagues, I think people get just even getting a foot in the door as an assistant or a shopper or a PA, they will be meeting people, and those people on a job down the road, they'll call them and say, I've never done this before. What? And there's a lot of generosity in the business of sharing information, advice. So I think I started as a shopper, was before I got to be an assistant designer. And that was hauling fabric around New York City. And
that's no joke. It's cardio.
But it was a fabulous job. And that's where you have to realize, even if you went to like got the master's or the PhD in design work, this is where you will begin.
Right.
And I think you've got to be super reliable, attentive, quiet. Which I know I'm very chatty, but I realize as you're going up, you're the person who's writing notes. You're not the person butting in. I think it will work out if you hang in there. When I realize I have this Hollywood career, it seems ridiculous to me. I grew up in
Manchester.
You don't
just have some Hollywood career. You have a huge Hollywood career.
It's weird. I feel... How did that happen? I would never have.
It's like a Talking Heads. How did I get here?
Yes.
This is not my beautiful house.
I know, exactly. Exactly.
Well, do you have a social media presence? Can people follow you on social media?
You're a very tiny one.
I can't add you on Insta?
I am on Instagram. I'm Shay Cunliffe. And I posted during COVID times, I did a lot of, I had a day of radio interviews. Phone interviews with journalists, and I realized that the secret of Dolores's transforming dress was out, because I'm very, very careful.
I don't share this morning.
Well, so I put it up there just to cheer people up as everyone was trapped. And then I suddenly was like on the front page of Reddit. I didn't even know what that was. My niece called and said, you know, you're on Reddit. Then I had like
then you really made it.
Then I had a million teenage friends that was nice, but I didn't know that I really. And then I think the way everything's gotten crazy in society in the last year, I've kind of removed myself from all of it. I feel it's a force of tremendously great things, of discovering things you love and getting in touch, but I also think it's got an appalling side. So for the last year, I don't think I've put anything. I used to put my cat up there sometimes, but I will start again, but I'm not terribly self-promoting it.
There's a lot of people that are looking in terms of if you kept it professional, here's and more of a more of a documentary feel to what you're doing. So putting up your design work, I think there's a lot of people that would be interested.
Yes, I might start doing that. Like Eduardo Castro, who's a wonderful designer, right? He's, I think, more on Facebook, but on Instagram, he posts wonderful stories, long stories from his amazing years. I think that's like a service to people. It's a sort of an informal. I'll start maybe as I get my office finally clean next year. I'll start putting things back.
Well, Shay Cunliffe, I want to thank you so much for your time and being with us.
Thank you so much. We loved having you here. It was so great to get to know you and talk about everything you've done. So amazing.
Yeah, it's been great to have you here on the Designing Hollywood podcast. It was great to work with you as well.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for letting me be here and talk with you and you. I've had such a great time. So informative. It's great.
A special thanks to our guest, Shay Cunliffe, and for coming on the show. And a special thank you to founder and executive producer, Martico Ibarra, and the legendary costume designer, Marilyn Vance, the great producers of this show. And thank you to John Campia for hosting this show on the John Campia YouTube channel. My name is Robert Meyer Burnett, and you can find me on Twitter at BurnettRM or find me on Instagram at RMBurnett. Thanks very much, and we'll see you on the next episode of the Designing Hollywood podcast. Special thanks to our sponsor for this episode, the Western Costume Company. The Western Costume Company is a one-stop shop for costume designers, customers, and stylists. Since the early days of Hollywood, over a century ago, Western Costume has been an industry mainstay. Whether you work in film, television, theater, commercials, or fashion, you'll find what you need at their vast warehouse.